the Oral History Committee of the Montgomery County Historical Society. The Historical Society, in cooperation with the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and the Heritage Alliance, is attempting to interview on videotape men and women who had the honor of serving in the armed forces during World War II. The inspiration of this for this series came from the recent series on the Civil War, in which the veterans of the Battle of Gettysburg met on the 50th anniversary of that battle down in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and exchanged stories. We have found a vast variety of experiences right here in our own county that came out of World War II. We want to thank the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the Heritage Alliance for their financial support for this effort. We also want to thank Ed Miller, who has done many of the much of the photographing, much of the camera work, and Claire Chamberlain of the American Legion, who has done a number of the interviews. Unfortunately, he was not able to be here today. Our cameraman today is Mike Hall, who is Executive Director of the Historical Society. So, we're going to start out today and ask our interviewee to give us his name and his date of birth.
Ready to go. My name is Dwight Williams, 1510 East Main Street, Carlisle, Indiana. And for further identification, I still remember my service identification number, which is 76798. My birthday was August 29th, 1908.
So you're getting up there, Dwight.
Yes, yes.
All right, where were you born?
Florisville, Indiana.
And who were your parents?
My parents was Clinton A. Williams, and my mother was Letitia Williams. And they're both deceased.
And what was your dad's occupation?
The superintendent of mails at the local post office.
All right, now you grew up, and did you go to the Carlisle schools?
Went to the rector schools here, grade schools, junior high school, and high school, and then later graduated from Wabash in 1930.
Whose class was that? Was that Byron Tripp's class?
That's right. I graduated with Byron. Very nice fellow. Byron died several years ago in Kennedy.
Oh, Lord. And what did you do after you got out of Wabash?
Starved. I got out in 1930 after the stock market crash. We'd go to get a job, and the guys had laid off, get out of the way, and the guys got laid off. And so my dad had several city lots. And what I did the first year I graduated from Wabash, what I did, I raised, he put that lot, several lots and potatoes, and I held my hand.
You planted these lots and potatoes. Where were these lots?
Okay, on North Whitlock Avenue, what they call the Sunrise Edition.
Oh, I know where that is.
Okay.
Okay.
So I sold those potatoes for $1 a bushel. I sold 100 a month. So my total income for 1930 was $100.
You didn't keep on selling potatoes. What did you do after that?
Well, I finally went to work for my brother.
And where was that?
Sims Williams Electric. Yeah.
And where was it located at that time?
South Green.
South Green Street. Where would that be?
About the 100 block.
I wonder what's there now. Is it
the tail end up? Used to be Goodman's building.
Oh, I see. Goodman's.
The old German Review was.
Okay.
And of course, we went north of that. There used to be a Western Union there.
Yeah.
Also, Security and Abstract was there. The rear end of the building, and Clark Chris Talley.
Now, let's talk a little louder.
Okay.
Right, if you can. Now, one of the things that came up here before we started talking was that you met Mrs. Lane, the wife of Governor Lane. Tell us about that.
Okay, my brother was in business, and I was just a kid, and I did little things for him. And one thing he had me to do, I believe it was a toaster that because he wanted me to take over Mrs. Lane. So I walked over to the big box and delivered that toaster to her. Like this very memory.
Was she living in this house then?
Oh, yeah. Lived in this house at the time.
And do you remember anything else about her?
No, to me she seemed like an elderly woman because I was just a kid. And older people tend to look Asian. If you know what I mean.
Oh, you went to work for your brother at Sims Williams. Was he an older brother?
Oh, yeah.
What was his name?
Fay was his name.
And
about 12 years older than me.
And how long did you work for him?
Well, I worked in there for several years, and I finally became a partner with him. When I went to the service and come back from the war, and I became interested in the business. In fact, I became a partner, bought some shares of stock, and so forth.
All right, now, Dwight, somewhere along the line here, did you get married?
Yes, I got
married. When was it?
1941. I said two things happened in 1941. They bombed Pearl Harbor, and we got married in 1941.
What was the date of your marriage?
June the 1st, 1941. But they finally got this Pearl Harbor deal all settled, but I told everybody that this war is still going on.
All right. Who did you marry? What was her name or maiden name?
Name was Carver, Doris Carver.
And you're still married to her?
I'm still married, yeah.
All right.
We had our 50th wedding anniversary here a couple of weeks ago.
Now, tell us how you happened to go in the service.
Well, my wife, Liv, worked for the Selective Service Board at the time. And of course, I was subject to the draft. And of course, she could see my number coming up. And so she told me the number was coming up. And so I thought, well, what I will do, I'll see if I can get in the Navy. I prefer the Navy. At that time, the only way to get in the Navy, you had to enlist. And you had to enlist for 4 years. And so she said my number was coming up, so I went up to Great Lakes, and she called me. And I got a letter from I had a college degree, majored in math, and some fellow up there said he wanted to come up and talk to me. He was in the officer procurement section, as they call it. And so I went up there and interviewed him, and he said, yes, we'd like to have you as an officer. And he said, you're not very tall. I said, no, I'm not. And he told him my height. And he said, your half is too sharp to be an officer. And he said, I can make you a petty officer. I said, listen, man.
Uh-huh.
So I went in for third class storekeeper. And then I began second class, first class, and then finally ended up as chief.
All right, now, Dwight, tell us about those. When did you go in the service? What date? Do you remember?
Yes. It was March the
20th, 42. So it was after Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
And where did you go up the Great Lakes or where?
Yeah, I went up the Great Lakes to take the boot train, as they call it.
All right, and where did they send you?
Okay, and then after that, I was a third class storekeeper. And then I went to what they call an OGU, outgoing unit. And then they assigned me to Northwest University. And went in there as ship's company. Whoever operated the base, they call out to ship's company.
Ship's company?
Ship's company. That's the operating personnel.
All right. And what did you do at Northwestern?
Well, I did several things. One thing is, first thing I did, I opened up the floating in small stores, furnished uniforms for money. And then I shifted over to the pay department. That's dispersing. And so I headed up the pay department.
Mm-hmm.
We shipped around the different things to get you different experience so you could go up in rate. I was third class storekeeper, then I went to second class, and before I left, I became first class. But after I left there, they sent me down there. There was an admiral came up there from the Great Lakes, and he saw all the fellas sitting around there doing women's work, and he said, those guys ought to be out to sea.
And so when was this?
This is about 1944.
44?
Okay. About 2 years.
You were there at Northwestern for 2 years?
2 years, that's right.
All right, then what happened?
Well, they sent me down to Camp Bradford. And we just
Bradford?
Virginia. And then I was assigned to an LST, but I never went aboard that because they had more storekeepers than they had LSTs. And so the ship, they had another program going, what they call it, LSM, landing ship, medium. It was a smaller ship, a faster ship, and only had about 55 enlisted men and 5 officers. It was only a little over 200 feet long. But that's when they begin to have to end. Expand the amphibious program. Of course, that's back in
what did LSM stand for?
Landing ship medium.
Medium, okay. All right, did you ship out then?
Yes. The first thing we did was about the Little Creek, LR, and Eastern training there, aboard ship. Everything you had to do, they put you through the mill. And then we finally ended up in Okinawa. That was the invasion.
Invasion of Okinawa.
That's when it was.
How did you get over to Okinawa?
Oh, by LSM. Right through the Panama Canal.
But with that LSM?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
That must have been a large ship.
Well, a little over 200 feet long. The way you designate a ship in the Navy, it has to be 200 feet or longer. Then you got a ship. Anything less than that, they refer to it as a bunk.
Was that pretty rough going across the Pacific on a small ship like that?
Oh, yes, yes, awfully rough. Because it's sort of a flat bottom ship, it has to be to make landings on beaches.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have to make a hull like a battleship.
Yeah. When did you go across?
Well, that was in about, let's see, that happened to be, a ship left Norfolk in February.
Oh, 44?
Yeah, 44. And then we went down to the Panama Canal, and then we went to Pearl Harbor, then we went to Anahuita.
Anahuita?
Yeah, the Pacific. And then we finally made the invasion of Okinawa. And the Japs held Okinawa at that time.
Okay. But did you go, were you on the landing craft when you made the landing?
Absolutely. I stayed there himself. The war was over.
Well, tell us about the landing.
Landing. Well, Japs held it. And of course, we had to take it over. And of course, what we had to fight mainly was the so-called kamikaze planes.
Kamikaze.
Kamikaze, yeah.
And did you have any of those attacks on your ship?
Yes, lots of times. Well, the whole group of the fleet, and the way the Japs would do it, they were instructed to pick out the biggest ship in the acreage. And they had, they'd come in about 3 at a time, and they had a commanding officer up there telling them where to go, where the fellows were going to make a motion, go get that one, go get that one, see. And so, the prize target was an aircraft carrier. The second thing was a battleship. The third thing was a cruiser. And then the fourth thing was whatever was big in there to go after. And so we had to fight those planes all the time.
Well, now when you speak about fighting, how did you fight them? What were you?
Oh, we had guns aboard our ship. So in fact, we shoot from the ship.
Did you have to man any anti-aircraft batteries?
I didn't. But the thing about it, I wasn't assigned to any particular gun. They had fellows assigned to different guns. Mm-hmm. Get the idea?
Yeah.
Now, of course, maybe watch, maybe from 4 to 8 in the morning. And of course, most of the crew was not there. And then, of course, the plane would come open out of sight. You just grab a gun and start shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I wasn't assigned to.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. But you were still doing your storekeeper role?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I furnished all the supplies for the ship, furnished the ammunition for the ship, and things of that nature. And anybody would tell me to get something for me. Of course, when we got ashore, I'd go to the supply station and get it.
Now, what about the problem of supplying a ship like that when you're getting ready for, did you stock up somewhere before you got to Okinawa?
Well, yes, you also had supply ships at the Okinawa Embry Agency. so you go to another ship and get fresh food.
And that's where they had, in other words, they had supply ships anchored around there where you could go and get this stuff. But you stayed right on the
LSN.
Tell us about the assault. Was that a did you all go in to get, did they take that landing craft right into shore?
Yes, not sure that was it, the landing went into shore. You see a ballast, there was no ports on to robots you could land. So you had to slide up on the beach to get it. And when you stood up on the beach, you opened up the bow doors and roared and ran, and then they went ashore. What we carried on the original landing was Army flamethrowers, the big tanks, 45 ton tanks.
Tanks with flamethrowers on.
And of course, when they go ashore, they go to these Japanese pillboxes, and of course, they shoot that flame in those pillboxes, and boy, and the Japanese in there, they come out in a big hurry. Then you kill them.
Yeah. Did you witness this sort of thing?
Oh, yes, I was there. Yeah, front row.
What was your function there during the landing operation? What were you doing?
Well, I was the captain's talker.
The captain's what?
Talker. I was on the phone, see, and I had a big helmet on, big helmet, because you had to have a big helmet to cover up your phones. And the order, the captain would give the orders, and I'd repeat that out over the phones to everybody at the instance.
Oh. Yeah. Well, to the phones, well, what did you mean? The individual tanks had phones in them, did they? And you repeated the captain's orders?
Well, of course, everybody aboard the ship had it. Station and they had a phone. Right? The captain would give me orders, and if it's on 20 millimeter, I'd say 20 millimeter attention, this is a con.
And I'd
the order from the captains. And these are sound powered phones, and they were very good, very clear. You could hear it real good. They didn't have any electric or anything like that. Because the ship was only a little over 200 feet long, so it was highly successful. The phones were. And
well, I don't understand though, did these other, the people receiving these, did they have earphones on?
That's right, yeah.
And you were, and this was radio or?
Just what's called sound power. And of course you
sound said, power?
Yeah, and there was no electric to it at all. And of course for short distances, you could use
them. Uh-huh.
And of course, our ship was only 200 feet. We had no problem at all. The reception, the quality was very, very good.
All right, now you described this landing craft. What other types of landing craft went in with you?
LSTs was another landing craft.
What are LSTs?
Well, they're bigger than we are. They're 360 feet long. I was originally assigned to an LST, but they finally shipped me over to an LSN. Then there was also what they called...
What is an LST? What's the difference?
Landing ship tank.
Oh, that's tanks.
Tank.
But you have tanks on your outfit.
That's right.
Okay.
It was still the same thing, only a smaller size, and they can get up on the beach faster than you know. LSTs, they have a terrible time getting them off the beach. And sometimes they go up on the beach to high tide, and then the high tide would go down. And they would sit there on the beach, they couldn't get off. And have to wait for time to come back up. So the LSN could get in and out. In fact, they lost a lot of LSTs because they couldn't get off the beach. The Japs would bomb them, turn them to pieces.
Yeah. Now, what was about the date that all this happened and you made that landing? Do you remember?
Yes. April Sunday.
April?
Yeah, Sunday, it was Easter Sunday.
Easter Sunday.
That was a terrible way to celebrate Easter Sunday by killing people.
Yeah. And you all went in there, those flamethrowers went in there.
Yeah.
Did you have any other men that went in from their ship?
Yes, the infantry to go in too, but they went with the flamethrowing tanks.
Uh-huh.
On the side of them.
Did you see any Japs and see them physically?
Oh, well, what we do when we were dome, when the Japanese kamikaze planes would dive after us, we could see the POW. Because the POW would only be maybe not far away than he was. And see, like the Japanese POWs, to begin with, they're small stature. And I think they had kids on them, was only 12 or 13 years old, flying those planes. And of course, they really had young folks that way because it's a long time mission. They didn't want to use a good experienced pilots, and they did not want to use a good planes. So there was all the junk of planes they brought in.
Yeah. Now, how many times do you recall that your LSM was attacked by a kamikaze?
Well, of course, we were under general quarters better than 200 times.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I left them always, the Japanese planes, but they could be in the vicinity, so we had to be in our general quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So forth like that.
Did they ever hit you?
No.
Yes, they did
hit once, but it wasn't very much for damage. But the plane hit just the side of, the Japanese POW, they hit us, but not very much. See, the only thing that the Japanese POWs had, they had on the front of the plane, they had their explosives, and then when they hit, man, they made a big splash. But that also was the end of the Japanese POW. They tell me those Japanese POWs, they knew when they sent them out, they were not coming back. And so they had their funeral services before they left.
Oh.
In Japan, that's something.
Now, Dwight, did you ever see a kamikaze hit another ship besides it?
Lots of times, sure, yeah.
Right on this particular landing here?
Yeah, well, not the landing, it was kamikaze powers were going after ships, not land, see. So
in other words, this was before the landing, you saw this happen.
And then after the landing, the ships were being anchored, you know, and they were still coming bomb.
Uh-huh.
See, when the ship would get in the anchor there, oh, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, 2 or 3 months, and so forth like that. And I know the closest ship we had, we were at general quarters, here comes a Japanese plane, and here comes what happens? And I'm like, oh, this has got to be it, this is the current. But the strange thing about it, we were tied up right next to another big ship, and there was another ship on the other side of that, so it's from the sky. We looked like a manned ship.
Mm-hmm.
But after Polly got so close to us, he could see that we were just several smaller ships, and that was not a good target. And so he pulled away right at the last minute, and I could see him, and I went in for me, then I from you. So I'm very close.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like to be a kid about 10 or 12 years of it. He's quite Japanese or small than hell. And then what he did, he came up over our ship and went over to a cruiser that was about 200 feet away, and there he goes into the bridge. That is where all the control of the ship is, you know, the captain and the navigator.
Did he hit the bridge?
Oh, he hit the bridge, yeah.
That's
right. Kill him.
Oh.
They went down through about 2 or 3 decks to him, and I walked over, jumped over our ship, and caught another ship, and see, it was a terrible sight. And the thing about it was, the ship was this way. I couldn't figure out what was going on. But this was the propeller. So the bow of the ship was going down.
Mm-hmm. The ship went down?
Yeah, the ship went down.
And well, that was on this initial landing there?
Yeah, 2 or 3 days later, 4 days later, something like that, all at the same time. They were all about 30, 60 days.
All right, now what did you do after the initial landing? Were you stay on the ship?
Oh, yeah, I never got off the ship.
Mm-hmm.
I was on board ships of like 210 days in a row, and not all of it. That's a long time.
All right, and this was in the late winter, or I suppose early spring.
Early spring.
1944.
Yeah, because we started off, left Pearl Harbor on February of 1944. We're getting ready for the invasion. It took about 30, 60 days to make the invasion. That's a long ways to go to make an invasion.
Yeah.
But Pacific is big.
Yeah. I can imagine how it was on that little ship on the Pacific.
Yeah.
Did you have any storms on the way?
Oh, that's the thing we had to fight. I'll tell you about storms. Over there, they have what they call typhoons. And so we would pray for typhoons, because when the typhoon was on, Japanese did not attempt to bomb us. Mm-hmm. So it was a good deal. But what we didn't know, was too dumb to know, that the typhoons was worse than the Japs. Mm-hmm. Now you can shoot at Japs, but you can't shoot at typhoons.
Did you have any, were you in a convoy going over?
Well, yeah, there were several of us in the group, yeah.
You had protection from cruisers?
Well, we went over as we had to go about 30, 60 days to make the invasion at Okinawa. And of course we went in a group,
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go by yourself, no.
Yeah. All right, how long after, did you see any Japanese on shore when you were there?
Well, we did. I went ashore to get supplies after we took over the island, and you can also see Japanese cruisers.
Mm-hmm.
They just walked along with the guy behind with the gun and so forth.
Prisoners?
The prisoners, yeah, prisoners of war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was there much fighting there after the after that initial landing?
Yeah, there was.
They had to get up there in the mountains and...
Yeah, you see, after you bomb, you see the infantry still has to take over. Even though
mm-hmm.
the bombing can be highly successful, but the final is the infantry.
Yeah.
So the infantry went in. They cleaned up the messes, cleaned up the strays, and so forth like that. And they took them on the prisoners.
Mm.
And a lot of prisoners were tickled to death to give up.
Yeah. All right. How long did you stay there in Okinawa?
Well, I was there about 60 days.
And where did you go after that?
Well, home. Because they dropped the bomb on Japan to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I was out there and they dropped the atomic bombs. And then after that happened, the Japs pursued for peace in the Philippines. And they left Japan and went to the Philippines. And I got to MacArthur was, and we could see the Jap, these planes going over to meet with MacArthur.
You saw those Japanese planes?
Oh, yes.
Going over to meet with
MacArthur. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Were those Japanese planes based on Okinawa or in Japan?
No, they were based on Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were bringing the high personnel from Japan. So
yeah.
The high personnel in Japan.
How did you know that they were, that was what they were?
Oh, well, we knew how they was for some reason or other, but you're asking me to remember something about 40 years ago, and the memory's not that good.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dwight, can you remember any other highlights from your war experience that you'd want to talk about? Let's take a little recess here, Mike, and let Dwight look at his look at his paper here. Dwight, tell us about those typhoons. That's interesting.
Well, the typhoons.
How you managed to handle those typhoons?
Well, to begin with, when they had typhoons, that was the end of the war. There was no bombing by the Japanese. That was a good thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, what you usually go out to sea and ride it out. Because of ships in the Haitians, they hit one another, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
So they sail you out to what they call the typhoon hub, which was a terrible thing and a big thing you have to worry about. As long as it's in the waves coming at you, it's okay. But so you have to turn around and come back. And that turn around, well, a big wave would come on and turn the ship over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrible. So that's the thing you have to worry about, the typhoons. In fact, we used to pray for typhoons, because when they had typhoons, the Japs would come over and bomb us. But the typhoons were worse than the Japs. And of course, the Japs, you could shoot at them, but you couldn't shoot at a typhoon.
No. Right, you mentioned something about 50 people in
maybe 50 people got killed.
50 people got killed, and what was the occasion of that? What happened?
Well, this was on a battleship in New York. And of course, it comes to Kamikaze Blade, right trying to go for the New York. Okay, so we could see a Kamikaze Blade, and it was destroyer next to us shooting out five-inch shells, and he was firing at that Kamikaze trying to knock it out before it got there. But the bad thing about it was, our five-inch shell hit the bridge of the New York, our own shell, course, the guy was...
Hit the bridge of the...
Hit the bridge of the new...
Of our American ship?
Yeah. And of course, he wasn't looking at the ship, he was looking at the plane, you know, and so forth like that. Then, of course, the kamikaze plane went in just a second later, but the damage had already been done by our own ship. After I was out there and seen that thing, I said, Dwight, you've got two ways to try to stay alive. Stay alive for the Japanese, also stay alive for your ships, too.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of accidents and so forth.
Sure. And tell us about that fellow that fell overboard.
Well, okay. Some way, somehow, they got a bottle of beer. Some way, somehow, they had canned beer out there. I think he had too many...
You'd be in charge of the canned beer, wouldn't you, if you were...
No.
Or
that's what they call ship service.
Okay. I thought maybe in charge of storage, you'd have that.
And you could get beer out there without any trouble. That was no problem. And so I think he had a few too many beers, and so he got over the end of the ship, and he fell down to him. Ship nestled again, see.
Yeah.
And so he fell down to him that way. And so the two ships come together, boom, and crashed him in the hips. And it was all, we thought he was gone. We finally got him out and took him ashore, put him in a hospital in Okinawa, and he survived. How many more he survived? I don't know. I thought he was gone because ships weighed tons, you know, and two ships come together.
Yeah.
Oh. And he was the chief aboard our ship, whatever.
Chief Petty Officer?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, Dwight, what, you got any other highlights that you want to cover?
Well, let's see. Well, I was at 200 days of combat.
200 days of combat.
That's a lot.
Did you ever get hit yourself?
No, never got hit. Nobody aboard our ship got hit. But that one guy aboard our ship, twice between two ships, but he survived.
Of course, those fellows that went ashore with those tanks, those flamethrowers, some of them got hit.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was not part of our ship.
Yeah.
We just barely to put them ashore. We also put infantry ashore, that was the army.
And did they,
some of those guys never come back down.
Were the flamethrowers that went ashore, did they ever come back to your LSN?
Well, it did, yeah. But it was just ashore, you see the LSN, they sail up on the beach, they come back and told us what the rough time they had. And I think they lost the tank, flamethrower. And one of the guys that was flamethrower got killed too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Of course, I suppose a number of the infantrymen got hit.
Oh, yeah.
When they got hit, did they bring them back to your LSN or did...
No, they go to, what's it called? Medical Corps, see.
Medical Corps.
Always had those with you. And of course, they had a medical ship, they went to hospital ship, they go for a ship.
Yeah. All right, what, take it that you pulled away from Okinawa then, and where did you go after that?
Well, on the way home. At the end of the war, so you're going home.
You probably had enough points to get out of it.
Remember, I didn't come back on our ship, because our ship was marked to go up to Japan and occupy Japan, occupation forces. But, so they kicked me off the ship in Okinawa there, and I had to get home the best way I could. So I went ashore and asked him what ships were going back. He said, there's a brand new aircraft carrier there named Vela Gump.
What was it?
Vela Gump, an aircraft carrier.
How do you spell that?
V-E-L-L-A and G-U-L-F, two words.
Vela Gulf, I never heard of that.
Yeah, of course all aircraft carriers have names, so all battleships have a name, like the ship New York. And then there are names from my numbers. We never had a name for our ship, we call it LSM-173. But our captain was from Excelsior Springs, Arkansas, but we call it the USS Excelsior Springs, just a joke way.
Yeah. All right. They put you aboard this aircraft carrier?
Yeah. It was on the way home. And there was a brand new aircraft carrier. Never seen any action at all. And it was up around Japan when they called, when the war was called off after they dropped the atomic bomb. And so they come back to Okinawa, and so I come home there. I mean, got aboard ship, fell in Bella Gulf that time. It was a brand new ship, spotless. Boy, it was a nice ship. Never see any action or anything. And so I come all the way back to the coast, California. And that's when the aircraft carriers docked.
And were you discharged there then?
Well.
Or did you come back to Great Lakes?
I come back to Great Lakes. I got my discharge there.
Okay. I'm kind of interested to know, what were the quarters like that you had to live in on your LSM?
Very tight. In fact, we had five bunks, one right at the top of the other, and there was only about 18 inches between them. And when you turn over to your knee, and the other guy turns his knee, and the other way slept head to foot. See, it was a Navy rain. And so we always sleep head to foot. Somebody would turn over underneath you, get hit you in the face, or hit you in the belly, the moon, so forth like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about that much, and there was five bunks here.
Now,
yeah. The car, nasty aboard ship, you don't have any extra space for anything.
Yeah, was it food?
Food, it was pretty doggone good. In fact, one of my jobs was to get the food, and the cook would tell me a list of food you want me to get, see. And so we always had good food, a lot of food, and the cook, of course, that's one of the things the cook did. He tried to make good food aboard ship. He was a good cook, and so we had...
Just had one cook for how many people on that ship?
Well, we had 55. We had 50 enlisted men and 5 officers. And sometimes we would carry a crew, and these tanks, you know, the infantry, they had to put on about 40 more men. But you don't have any extra space.
Now, Dwight, did you make any good friends when you were in the service?
Yes, you do that.
Do you remember your officers or the men you served with that you have fond recollections of, or some guy you hated?
Yeah, no, I got along. I was everybody very good. And there's a fellow I still hear from, one of my officers. And I was 32 years old when I was aboard ship, and he was just ensign of school. I think he was about 20 or 21.
Uh-huh.
And I still correspond with him. I've been to his house, he's been to mine.
Where does he live?
That's Michigan, isn't it? Where Bob lives.
Tell him about me.
And say, where does Bob live?
Marinette, Wisconsin.
Marinette, Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, pardon me.
We get together. Tell him about us getting together every year.
Oh, yeah, that's another thing.
Well, that's my way to cover that. Do you have any reunions of your outfit?
Well, okay, now the fellas up at Northwest University before I let aboard ship, and we get together every year.
Uh-huh.
Now, but the fellas aboard ship, I've never seen them on just spare rock. We never had a ship reunion on that. This guy sort of come.
But this ensign that you were mentioning, was he aboard ship or was...
No, he was aboard ship, and I see him quite a bit. So far, we got another fellow named Bob Greer. I'm not aboard ship with him, and he lives in Arizona, so I don't see him real often. I saw him from Brooklyn. Now, the first time I met him, he scared me to death. He spoke that Brooklynese to him. I said, oh, it's Terry, that guy, he's from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. But he was a nicer guy you don't want to meet.
What did you think of the officers as a whole? How were they?
Oh, all right, yeah, most of them were young, and my captain, I was a couple years older than the captain. I was very close to the captain. I was his talker. When he was at his battle station, I was just that far from him, so I could hear everything he said, because I had to repeat, so they'd have to decide where to go. The engine room of the quartermaster, navigation. And he was from...
Do you go to every one of these reunions at Northwestern?
Yes, I do. I think I missed one. But we've been since 1946. And these fellows are pretty nice guys. And the ship's company up to a lot of the college graduates. And so the captain, when he left us, went down to the station. He said it was the best ship's company he ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was highly complimentary. Yeah, we get together. In fact, we just got through the other one. In fact, we have our 50th wedding anniversary, June 1st, 1991, out to Holiday Inn. And so, I thought we would blend in the ship's company reunion. So we had the ship's company reunion. Now, the first one we had was in 1946, and with the wives, there was something like 110 show up. But the guys are thinning out now.
Yeah.
And now I think there was only something like...
Do you meet at Northwestern every year?
No, no.
Where'd you meet this year?
Here in Crawfordsville.
Oh. Oh, you had them down here then?
Oh, I'm a retired, you know.
Yeah.
And it's still powerful.
Where do they come from?
Oh, my goodness. Not many from the middle.
Seven states.
Yeah, seven states, I think we had.
And we meet different places.
How many did you have at this last reunion?
Well, there was about 10 of them, and their wives, and then about 20. Now, the first one we had was something like better than 100.
Yeah. Now, Dwight, you've got your uniform on today. You know, there'll be very few of us that still may wear uniforms. How have you preserved that thing anyway? What'd you do to it?
Well, I thought you were going to say, how did you get in it?
Yeah, how did you get in? That's more important.
Oh, another deal. When I come back to the service, I just ate like a horse. And going out there, ice cream, Sunday, grabbing that, and everything like that. And so I started gaining away. And so I went to the doctor and asked him about it. And he checked my blood pressure. It was high. He said, you got dangerously high blood pressure. Dwight, you're going to have to go on a diet. So he put me on a diet. And so he put me on a diet. Then I kept my weight. I kept my uniform on. So I still got that same weight I had shortly after the service.
Yeah.
But for a long time, then I couldn't wear it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break here, Mike. I want to get these... why don't we just take a look at these two? Take a photograph of you first, on the light. Mike, can you see those?
Yeah.
I suppose the one that won't reflect could probably be the better one, won't it?
I can get this one good. It's
you get that one pretty good?
Focus and good.
Okay. Mike, what is this picture here that I've got?
Well, that's a picture when I was in the Navy and I made second class reading at that time.
Were you at Northwestern?
I was still at Northwestern University at that time.
All right. Now you've got another one here. What is that?
Third class.
That was before you...
Before I made the second class.
Okay. And that was when you first went in?
Shortly after, maybe 3 months after.
Okay.
Now this was taken about a year after.
All right. Now, I notice here that... you've got your regular Navy and Naval Reserve service record.
Yeah.
That's
unusual to see.
That's unusual to see. That's what we call in the Army, we call that your 201 record. That's usually kept by the year out. You happen to have that. And that's a little unusual.
Yeah, unusual. Very unusual.
Shows all your orders and so on. You want to take some time off? Can you focus in on that, Mike?
Yeah.
Dwight, what is this picture here, this photograph?
Well, that's a picture of the ship and the crew. It's the LSL.
We can take them through this train and get ready to go to the invasion.
Did all these guys go across the
wall? Yes.
How many would you say are still living?
Well, it's awful hard to say, but I'd say that maybe a third of them or something, I think.
Yeah.
Because you see, I killed 2 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, well, I know. Dwight, tell us about your what happened to you after the war.
Well, after the war, I come home. Be the first thing you try to do, and I come back and Miller Gulf aircraft carrier landed out in California, and then I come to Great Lakes to be discharged, and then I told my wife I'd go to Indianapolis. We had no second honeymoon. I'd be in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Then Indianapolis, you come home. I went in business with my brother, and she. And we used to have respective service endorsement.
I was working for the better of life.
I went to work for the better of life. And she was working out the better of life.
You continued, how long ago did you retire?
Well, I retired when I was 58 years of age.
58?
Yeah, I was 58. 1958, yeah, it's been quite a few years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
It was 1967.
30 years ago.
Yeah, 1967. Well, I retired from, well, my brother was in the process and he wanted to sell the business. He was older than I was. And I said, okay, I could accumulate a few dollars, go ahead and retire. And so, sold out the business to Remy Constantin, and he sold out shortly after that. And then, since that time, Bob, I've always been interested in securities. And so I took the money I made in the business to turn my investments and got with Hocus House from Indianapolis, and then as a result, they say, can I have a drink of water?
Yeah. Right, you said that you retired in 1958, was that that?
No, I was 58 years old.
58?
I was 66 when you retired.
66 when you retired, and then you went to work for Planning Investments,
yeah.
And that's when
yeah.
You've been handling investments.
Yeah.
And you find that at times things heavy on your hands at all?
I love what I'm doing, because I've always been interested in investments. When I was 1928, I was 20 years of age. My dad used to trade grains in the Chicago Motor Trade.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me interested in that, but I got all the grains, the kind of stocks. And then after I retired, I had a few more bucks. And so I've been highly successful in my investments.
All right, I want to cover another point that we always ask. Did you meet any of the fellows from Crawfordsville during the course of your service? Did you meet any fellows that you've known back home? Well, you met Barnum Tripp at that one time.
Yeah.
I was out of service
at the time. You were out of service? Out of service. He was going, I know I was in the service, but I was going back to the base in Northwestern, and he was going up to report to the Navy in the Palmer House, and he said he was going to be in personnel because it was right down his alley.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's been your career, and you've now been married for 50 years.
Yeah.
All right. I think that are there any other highlights that you that you didn't cover?
Yeah, cover that about the battleship in New York.
Yes, you did, about hitting the kill of those 50 men.
Typhoons. That was terrible. I think I'm gonna say that
I'm going to ask you what your ribbons are, okay?
Well, that's fire ribbons. You should know what they were. See my insignia here?
Yeah.
That's amphibious. One of these ribbons is amphibious ribbon. Now, of course, we got the American Theater of War, ASAP Theater, American, I got my Moon Star. That's the Asiatic Pacific.
Morning Star?
Yeah, then I got the American Theater, and then I got the
Does your wife take care of that uniform for you?
Well, I don't think.
How do you keep the moths out of it?
How do you keep the moths out of it? They have signs on it that said no moths.
No moths. I think that's all right. I love it.
Okay.
I love it.
Here's my other discharge.
This thing over here?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's your
golden pigeon.
That's me. I
don't deserve it. I want to thank you.
I should actually see the tape. I'll be very glad to
talk. But
I don't know when to shut up.
But we just had a sort of an interesting conversation after Dwight got through here, and as it turns out Dwight's wife worked for a while in the Selective Service, and then she had some interesting comments about what it was like to be a wife of a fellow in service. What was going on. Doris, tell us a little bit about working at the Selective Service Office. Do you remember, who was your boss?
Oh, Walter Spencer, and let's see, who were the other two? There was three of them. I can't remember the a man from Wayne Town. What was his name?
Alive and Good.
Alive and Good, yes. And I can't remember the third one.
And how long did you work for Selective Service?
Oh, I worked there, I think, for 2 or 3 years. I can't remember the name.
And when did you start? Soon as Selective Service came in?
Well, yes, just about the same time it came in. Yes, I did.
You were just a young thing then, huh?
Oh, yes, yes, quite young.
That's just out of high school, were you, what?
No, I've been out of high school for a while. I worked at the Farmer's Creamery. Yeah, for some time.
Did you work for Pegler?
No, Hayes.
Hayes, okay.
And I worked for Mr. Hayes, and I worked there at Rag and Butter, and then I was promoted to the office, and I worked at the office and wrote all the cream checks. And then I went to Selective Service and worked there for him.
And were you working, you were working at Selective Service when you married, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
When Selective Service first came in, you saw these fellows go off. Were you in charge of notifying people that their number was up?
Oh yes, yes, yes. We were sending these out, and of course a lot of them didn't want to go, and they tried it. Some of them did not go because of the fact they were farmers, you know, and they were needed on the farm. They were deferred.
Well, Spencer's pretty tough, wasn't he?
Yeah, yes, but I liked him.
Yeah.
he was real nice to work for.
Do you remember any of the people that went off and didn't come back?
No. Shuler. I forget what his first name was, but I know after Dwight left for service, she and I lived together in an apartment, and her husband left, and he was only gone, he was in the Air Force, and he was only gone a very short time, and he was reported missing.
So the war had already started.
Yes, And her name was Jerry Shuler, and she married, we married this Bummel here in town.
Bummel?
Yes,
Well, tell us about the workings of the Selective Service Office. You had the drawing, of course, and they had the drawing, everybody had a number, and...
Yes, we had a drawing, we had a number. One thing I remember that was interesting about this, one time, what's the name of the fellow that was, he's a movie actor. I can't remember his name, isn't that terrible? And he came up, if you ever had a change of address, you always had to notify us, you know.
Yeah.
And Stephen Crane.
Stephen Crane, yeah.
And he came up there, I remember, one day to change his address. I can't remember too much about it. It's been so long ago.
Was the Selective Service, what was that, a full-time job?
Oh yes, 5 days a week. We didn't work Saturday and Sunday, but it was 5 days a week.
And were there other people working in the office or just you?
One other.
Who was that?
Esther, she lived at Greencastle.
But your grant board just served this county, didn't it?
Yes. And then she left, and Mary Keller was the last one that came in and worked with me.
When in relation to the time that you left Selective Service and when Dwight went into service, how long was that? Did you stay with Selective Service while he was up there in the Great Lakes?
Oh, yes. No, I didn't. No, I'll take that back. When we got married, he said, you better stay here so you'll have a job.
Did you want your home by that time?
Oh, no. We just lived in apartments.
Okay.
No. And he was in Greenfield, and so I said, no, this may be the only time we'll have together. Because if you go into the service and you get killed, then we may not have any time together. So I decided that I would leave Crawfordsville and go over to Greenfield, which I did. and we were there a short time, and then he was sent, he was working for Sears and Roebuck at that time, and he was sent to Kankakee, and I went to Kankakee with him in the fall, and then we, it was, I think, about January or February that we left, because he was called into service at that time. And then I came back here, and...
Did you stay here then for a while?
Yes, I stayed here all the time he was gone, while he was in the service.
Even when he was up at Northwestern?
Yes, I went up on weekends, and I would spend a weekend with him, and when he had the weekend off.
Did you have another job then?
When I did, yeah.
Did you work for, went to the hospital, or Van Hunter, or where did you work?
Well, let's see, I worked at the hospital. I was working at the hospital, that was right. And then I didn't go to the Van Hunter until he was across Okinawa, I think, at the time. I changed jobs and went to...
Now, you described some of the, well, I thought that was kind of interesting, you described packing up suitcases and just following around the country. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'll tell you about this one trip. Of course, I went to North Carolina one time, Charleston, South Carolina. And then the other one was Norfolk. And I went down there to Norfolk, and Dwight knew I was coming. It was in the middle of the night, and it was storming. And I was always so friendly with everybody. My mother said, now don't be so friendly with everybody. And I was friendly. This man was sitting beside me, and I thought, well, you know, you have to talk to him. So it was 3 o'clock in the morning and storming. And this fellow said, do you have a ride into town? And I didn't have. And I thought, oh my land, now I have really got myself my foot into it now. And I thought, I just prayed Dwight would be there. And fortunately, he was. He was there. And he took me to a house that had just had a room he couldn't get into any place during the wartime. And I stayed with his family. And I couldn't be with him at nighttime, only just a little bit. He'd come in about 7 o'clock, and he'd be so tired that I would just sit there and look at him. And we didn't even have an alarm clock, and I'd have to get him up early in the morning. And then that would be the only time that I'd have with him. So I'd walk with him several blocks down to get the streetcar so he could go out to the base. And it would still be dark. And I would walk down the middle of the street because I was so afraid. This town was real dangerous, and they had a person had been killed on this street, and I was real scared. But I wanted to do that so I could be with Dwight.
No.
But another time, we were going to out to the West Coast, and I met my girlfriend in Chicago at the train station, and so we got a red cap and asked the red cap, said, now you be sure that you appreciate this. And we knew what he meant because he wanted a good tip. So we got aboard the train, and the people were sitting on their suitcases in the aisle. And of course, we were fortunate. We felt like that we got a chair, a seat, because, and we had 3 days to go now out there. And they didn't have any reclining seats. You sat straight up, and everything was so packed you couldn't even get to the dining car. And the trains that in that time was so old that they'd break down. So this time, going out to the coast, it broke down in the middle of the desert, and there we sat for two or three hours till they got it fixed, and then they took us on in.
No way of getting any air in there.
No, it was hot, yes.
You open those windows and get soot in there.
That's right. And then we get pulled into, L.A. We pulled into L.A. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. And when we had breakfast, my girlfriend, Tony, and I had breakfast. And so then we stood in line for 2 hours. And when the gate was open, no civilians could go aboard the train, just the servicemen. Mm-hmm. So then we had to figure out how we were going to get down to San Diego, because that's where the ship was docked. Mm-hmm. And we, let's see, we stood, we took a cab over to a bus station. And at this bus station, we stood in line for 2 more hours to get the bus down to San Diego. She got aboard and they shut the door in my face. So I stood for 2 more hours. And then I said, you be sure and tell why I'm coming. Anyway, in the meantime, he didn't even know I was coming. And I didn't even know whether I'd have a place to stay or not, but I had warned before I left to this U.S. Grant Hotel to have a room for me. Well, fortunately, I did have when I got there. So then Dwight came home. I guess he's out getting supplies, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and he came back to the ship. And he said, did you know your wife's here? He said, no, I didn't know. And he thought they was kidding. He just didn't pay much attention to him. And after a while, he said, don't you know your wife's here? And so then he got ready to come into the hotel, and he had to prove that he was my husband because they weren't letting everybody upstairs, see? Because in the morning, everything was so crowded.
Is that the U.S. Grant, you mean?
Yes. And you'd go down in the morning and people would be laying on the floors just sleeping on papers because there just wasn't any room. And I know one night we went out to get a hamburger. You couldn't stay longer than 10 days anyplace, so we had to keep looking for another place. So Tony and I looked for another place and finally got into an awful hotel. I think it was the wrong kind of a hotel. They didn't like us and they found out we were nice girls, so they tried to put us out. My room was up over the bar, and it was so loud and so noisy, and he couldn't come in that night. I was so scared. And anyway, one day we went out and got some donuts, and we came back, and it was hard to get food to eat, you know, because everything was just, there's so many people. And we broke those donuts in two, and they just were on. They hadn't even been cooked. So I set them over on a tray on the dresser, I think it was. The next morning, they'd been eaten by myself. So we just about had it. And then, so then we had, our 10 days was up there, but we were just glad to have a place to stay. So then we got back in the U.S. Grand again. So then the boys were to leave, and we were to go down to the dock and watch the ship pull out, which we did. But we could not wave to the boys because this would indicate that they were going out to sea, you know, and we, you know, if things were tight at that time, and they wouldn't let us wave out. So after they left, then we got aboard the train and started home, back home. And the trains were so awful, they just sounded like they were just going to fall apart.
Oh, yeah.
And when we got to, I think it was St. Louis, they took our car off and put another one on. And then when we got back on, then the next car was full of Japanese prisoners.
Oh.
So we had quite an experience in that. my experience was quite, interesting too.
Tell us about conditions back here in Crawfordsville. Was it tough to get food? Was food plentiful here, or was it hard to get things?
Well, yes, it was kind of hard. You know, you couldn't you had sugar stamps and things of that sort. And you had to have so many stamps to get some sugar, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing I can really remember. Of course, my mother and I lived out on the farm, and she had the farm, but the house was rented. We had 2 little rooms that my mother lived in the summertime, but then in the wintertime we got us the apartment came in town. But I never did go hungry. We always had something to eat, but you know, you had to have coupons for different things.
Now, the meat was tough to get, wasn't it?
Yes.
You didn't have stamps for meat?
Yes, yes. I think you did.
Were you aware of any of the fellows that didn't come back to Crawfordsville, and any of the friends of yours that were killed in service? Or
well, I can't remember. I can't recall now, with the exception of this Shula boy that didn't come back. I can't remember of any now.
How were conditions out at the hospital? You worked there in the hospital?
Oh, so busy. Oh, yes. You had to do everything. I was working, for instance, I was working on the telephone. I was a telephone operator. I made out all the paychecks for the hospital, and I was a bookkeeper, you know, along with it. And of course, then you had to, you had to work long hours and extra hours, Sundays, holidays, and you just didn't have much time off.
Did any of the doctors have to go off into the service? Do you remember?
No, I can't remember. I remember this about, they would give, doctors would give us an order to give a patient some kind of medicine, and medicines, there were so many medicines that sounded alike that I would make them spell out the medicine that they wanted. You know, you had so many extra duties to do at that time because it...
They were just short of help.
Yes, yes,
And you don't remember whether, what about the medical staff? Was it overworked when you were?
Yes. Everything was overworked at that time. Short of help, you know.
What was Crawfordsville like during the war? Do you have any recollections you'd want to tell about? The streetcar was still running, of course.
Yes, I guess it was. I don't remember anything particular. I know, let's see, I think, I'm trying to remember something that was, I know I missed Dwight a lot.
Yeah.
He was gone, I missed him a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, you didn't have much money to spend on any you know, going to show, because I was buying a new car at that time. And I
thought you got a car, I thought you couldn't get cars during the war.
Well, I think it was, wasn't it during the war when I bought that Ford? I think. I can't remember. Bert Etta was a cousin of mine, and I had an old car, and it was about to go to pieces. So I went down there. Maybe this was before the war, though. And I remember buying this Ford, and he said, "Have you got any money to pay down on?" I said, "No, all I have is this other old car." He said, "I'll take it." And he said, "You can pay me $35 a month." Because I was trying to keep my mother, who was trying to pay off the farm because she didn't have that all paid off yet. So he said, "How much can you afford to pay me a month?" And I said, "Well, $35 is all I can afford to pay you." And he said, "That's all right, I'll take it." So that's how I bought that new Ford. And it was, I think, $600.
Didn't have air conditioning.
No.
did you and Dwight correspond after he got a...
Oh, yes, yes. And we had a code. We had a code all set up so that I could always know where he was. And this code pertained to, I think it was the date. And it would represent a certain, whether it was A, B, or C, or, you know, part of the alphabet, see? And then it would start out, he'd start out the letter, and it may be this first word would indicate something that pertained to this, the ABCs, and I always knew where he was.
Did his letter get mushier as he got farther and farther away?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think they got any mushier. They were always pretty much the same. I was always glad to hear from him.
How often did you correspond?
Oh, gee. I suppose once a week or something like that.
Did you get those little email letters?
Yes. That's right, yes.
Okay.
And he had to be careful what he said, of course, you know, because they'd cut it out or wouldn't send it. But we fooled him because we had this code set up. Nobody knew that but him and I.
You went to work for, you were at the hospital, but when did you go to work for Ben Hur?
Well, I went to work for Ben Hur just before he came home about a year, I think. I don't know what year that was. And I was a receptionist down there.
Down there on the first floor?
Uh-huh. And then he was, when he came home then, I worked about another year after that.
And you quit work?
And I quit work, but they wouldn't pay me enough. I even bought bouquets of flowers. I told them they didn't pay enough to make my hose, so I quit working.
Yeah, it was a penny not as good even as the hospital.
Well, no, it wasn't very good either.
Well, I guess I've exhausted that. Shut it off a little bit, Mike, see if we can take it.
Well, when Dwight came back, of course I was so happy to see him, but it was like we'd been away from each other for 4 years, and you had to get readjusted to each other, and it was just like meeting him again. He said to himself, I don't know what to do with change in my pocket. I'm not used to having even money on me, because when he was out to sea, he didn't have any money.
Huh?
And it was little things like that that you know that you wouldn't think about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I had to get used to him, and he had to get used to me, and I had been living with my mother, and she missed me, and I felt sorry for her, and because she was lonely too at that time, and she was living here in town.
Was she a widow by that time?
Oh, my father died when I was about 18, okay. 19 years old, so he'd been gone.
Where were you living when, where did you live when you first came back?
We lived with his folks for a very short time. I said, this is not for me. I said, if I only have one room, we're going to have to get someplace else, because, you know, I don't think it's right for two families to live together. So, of course, he was working for his brother, and they had two apartments upstairs up over the store. And I said, I don't care if we only have one room. Well, we did. We had, a kitchen and a living room and a bedroom and up over the store. And we didn't have a decent chair to set in, but anyway, we were to ourselves. I'll tell you. They had just put some old furniture in there, you know, just so we have some sort of a place. And we were happy. You know, we were together, and he thought it was a mansion, because after all, he just lived in a small quarters on a ship, and he thought that little apartment was huge. So he was real happy, and I was too. We were by ourselves, and it was just, having him home was just wonderful.
Was he domestic at all when he got in, or did he help at all with the kitchen chores and all that stuff?
You kidding? That's not his cup of tea. No.
Did he get under your feet at all?
No, he didn't get under my feet. But I'll tell you what did happen. I know he and I have always liked to go to the movies. You know, we used to have real good movies in our heyday. And it was, of course, you know, we had three theaters in town.
Sure.
There was the Ritz and the Vanity and the Strand. And he and I both liked to go to movies, and so we'd go to movies a lot. That was our entertainment most of the time. What?
No TV.
No TV.
You spoke the Ritz and the Vanity. The Vanity is where the Vanity is now.
That's right. Yeah.
And the Ritz was over there on Main Street. Yeah.
That's right.
Where, let's see, was that where the Weather Bank was? Everybody in there somewhere?
Yes. That's about where it was.
Okay. Well, you know, Doris, this is great. I think she's even better than he was.
Well, thank you.
This is what we're trying to get. Okay, thanks a lot. I want to explain that these tapes that we're making are the property of the Montgomery Coroner County Historical Society, claiming a copyright interest in them. And we plan to give the original of the tape to the person being interviewed, and then we're going to put two copies at in the local history room of the Carbondale Public Library for the use of the public and be checked out. That's already been done with a number of these tapes. That's all I have.